Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi everyone, so we have something different for you this week. It's DJ here, and we sat down last Friday in our respective homes with Finn Dwyer from the Irish History Podcast and recorded a podcast that we're calling The Self-Isolating, and for the duration of time that this COVID-19 lockdown type scenario is on, we're going to be doing a couple of these type of things every Friday night live on the Irish History Podcast YouTube channel, and we'll release these as podcasts as well. So hope you enjoy it. Join us this Friday, and if you've got anything you want us to discuss, feel free to get in contact through social media with either ourselves or Irish History Podcast. Enjoy.
Are we live?
Yep.
Perfect. Hi everyone, welcome to the
I was like, wow, Finn, you pulled that out of nowhere. Sorry, that's it. Like, I'm not gonna go back now. Go on, little perfect shirt.
Listen, everyone, sorry for the wait there, the old technical glitches. Welcome to a crossover podcast between Irish History Podcast with Finn Dwyer and Snugcast with myself, DJ Walsh, and Owen Tabb. Lads, welcome to the virtual pub.
The self-isolating.
The self-isolating, yeah.
Yeah, man, technology is a crazy, crazy thing, isn't it? Man. I was just saying there before, when we thought we were live there about 10 minutes ago, that few friends of mine started using this House Party app, and like just on Paddy's Day there, we're all just like drinking away. We're six of us kind of on one screen, just drinking away. It's similar to this now, but yeah, it's crazy times. Everyone has to kind of move like that.
Yeah, it's mad, all right, isn't it? I mean, I suppose we're here. We were supposed to meet up for a couple of drinks this weekend, and it fell through, unfortunately. But we're here anyway, Skyping and broadcasting to a couple of listeners around the world. Finn, start off with yourself. What are you drinking tonight, pal?
I am going pretty traditional here. I have got a Guinness, draft Guinness in a can.
Yeah,
I'll be honest. To be honest, the cans were just in the shed. I didn't even, with all the no one wanting to go down to the shops and all, I just said, you know what, there's Guinness there, it's grand, I'll drink that.
Hey, nothing bad to be said about that.
For sure.
Brilliant. Owen, what are you drinking yourself?
I'm on Kildare Brewing Company, Fan City West Coast IPA, 6.5% IPA. It's pretty nice. Bit of hoppy, kind of citrusy. Yeah, it's nice. Very drinkable, but would probably blow the head off me now if I have a few more. But yeah, I'm enjoying it so far.
I had a can of that there before we came on, and it was beautiful. But I moved on to the Kildare Brewing Company Electric Juice IPA. It's a bit more sessionable at 5.5%. Very tasty, very fruity, actually. Goes down a treat. We actually stumbled across the Kildare Brewing Company by accident there the other day. And we bought some cans online, and they dropped them, delivered them to the door on.
Yeah, look, I think in the time that it is now at the moment, businesses are just moving all over the place and just having to pivot and get whatever sales they can. So Kildare Brewing Company put up a post on Twitter, and it was shared by Portlaoise Pub Club, actually. Basically, it just said, look, DM us if you're in the area, you can pick up. So they're based in Salins, County Kildare. And said, if you're in the local to the area, you can pick them up, or we'll deliver them if it's not like taking the piss. So we were like, grand. I was like, look, I'm on my way home. What time are you closed at? They said, where are you living? I said, Kilcullen, which is actually a fair bit away from Salins. But fair play to Barry, man. Just came along, dropped him over, sent a picture on to DJ. DJ then was like, I need a case of that. Straight away.
Buy the case the next day.
But yeah, it's so cool. Like, I think it's amazing. Like, all businesses now, even like places that are like Michelin star restaurants in Waterford, are now like just pivoting, and like the head chef is like making bread and selling bread at the door, like just you know, just to pass time and get some sales in, like, you know,
Michelin
wolf from the door.
Sorry, I'm like just not saying very much here at the moment, folks, but I'm actually just posting the link to Twitter, getting more people in, and just give me 2 seconds. As people can see at home, we are, as Owen was saying, though, it is that thing that like people are having to adapt all the time. And it's like you were saying, DJ, that thing we were supposed to do this ideally in a pub, but then you're just left with nowhere options. So I'm sure there's like that Michelin star restaurant that's like they're having panic attacks in the kitchen, but no one can see them. We're doing it live on YouTube.
Yeah,
panicking.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of modern technology. Like we can't make it to the pubs, but we can still have a drink together. Like, you know, I mean, fair enough. We can't clink our glasses like we like to do in the snowcast. But you know, we can still have a drink and enjoy each other's company virtually, which is absolutely brilliant. You know.
Yeah, I think that is actually, though, it's indicative of a much bigger thing. And I guess we're going to talk a bit about this, though, about how this, you know, because I guess I'm reticent a bit to talk about this, about historical analogies, you know, because I think things have changed so much in terms of, like, I suppose we talk about different historical pandemics, but it's even something like that we're talking about now, that we can sit here and do this over the internet, that makes things like social isolation possible. Whereas even like, forget like people talk about the 1918 pandemic or the Black Death. This wasn't possible even 10 years ago. Like think about 10 years ago, Skype wasn't half as good as it was. People didn't have broadband in their houses. So if you go back another century, you're into a whole other whole other situation. And I think it kind of makes me a bit optimistic, actually, about what we're facing, and that like we are the most prepared generation ever to deal with this.
Yeah, we definitely can cope a lot better, like even just in terms of like our communication channels to one another. And like, even though you're saying that like you don't want to go down to the shop to get things, but like most shops are just offering delivery now simply because they have to offer delivery in order to survive. Like there is a much bigger emphasis on businesses to survive. So like, yeah, we definitely are the most prepared that we could be, I suppose. And it's just getting better and better, I suppose.
I think there is, maybe to go on the doom and gloom side of it, and I don't think it is, and I think we have to be, I think it is worth being cognizant of that there's a lot of people almost like scaremongering and almost wanting this to be like an apocalyptic film. But there are things I think that maybe do put us at a bit of a disadvantage, and some of that is the interconnectedness of the world, that we're far more reliant on further away places. And I guess you guys, in terms of, like, can probably talk maybe a bit about like how this affects medicine, that like we're dependent on things to come from much further afield than say in 19, well, like obviously in terms of, you look at the Black Death, the level of medicine was way, way lower than it is today. But I just think that we're living in this interconnected world that's so dependent on like all these supply chains, and even beyond that, like in terms of technology and the reliance on huge amounts of, on huge systems to operate, that I would wonder, will this undermine that preparedness?
I think something that, I mean, something that puts that in perspective to me is, like, today is the 100th anniversary of the killing of Tomás McCurtain in Cork, the Lord Mayor of Cork. And on one of your previous podcasts, mm-hmm. you talked about the other Lord Mayor of Cork who died in that time frame, Terence McSweeney.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I went to the same school that both Tomás McCurtain and Terence McSweeney went to. And so we would have been taught about that a lot. And they died just a couple of years after the Spanish flu. So communications are very much in line with the time of the Spanish flu pandemic. And when you look at Tomás McCurtain was murdered, and it took a couple of days for that news to circulate around the world. And there was, like, we were showing newspaper clippings from, like, Australia, say, 4 or 5 days later, where it was being announced that it just happened. We're in the middle of a pandemic now, and we're getting daily updates of the total numbers of infected people, the total numbers of recovered people, and the total numbers of people who've unfortunately succumbed to the infection every single day by region around the world. So if you think about it, it took a couple of days to travel about a high-level murder to travel around the world 100 years ago, whereas now we are literally getting, like, basically time in, like data as it comes online is being spread around the world at an incredible rate. I think you're right in that it gives us certain advantages with medicine. We can adapt and take medicine approaches, public health approaches based on that. Basically, overnight you can shut down a country if you really want to. But the opposite then is that when you're getting all the information at once, it's very easy to read too much into it, get inside your own head, and basically create a dark cloud over the entire world overnight when you see the scale at which things are escalating in certain parts of the world. So it's a very good point to say that, like, we've never been better equipped to deal with a pandemic from being able to, like, mobilize around the world. But also we've never had so much access to information to drive ourselves mad either, you know?
I know. I think it's, well, it's like, how reliable is that information as well that's going around? Like, it's very hard to control it. Like, if you're talking about, like, that news of McCurtain and stuff being passed around, that's been passed probably from a journalist, you know, from a newspaper to maybe a UK newspaper onto a Aussie newspaper or whatever. Like, you know, it's going through these, like, telegram passages, whereas now, like, anybody can say anything online, and it just amplifies. Like, we had that kind of scaremongering thing about anti-inflammatories and COVID-19, as to just not take them because there's and there was another thing as well with ACE inhibitors, which are blood pressure medication, that, like, that just shouldn't be taking them because there's an increased incidence you're more susceptible to contracting COVID-19, or you're not going to handle the disease as well if you take these medications. So, like, there's been, like, subsequently then, like, the medical agencies have come out then and just completely disregard it and say there is no evidence against this thing, you know? So it's, yeah, like, complete scaremongering as well, like, you know, it's crazy.
That stuff, though, isn't, I was actually only thinking about this, that stuff isn't new, or certainly, and it might be interesting, actually, given that you have the expertise in terms of what's going on now, just even compared to something like the Black Death. Obviously, that took place in 1348, or that's when the big pandemic is, but there is interest in parallels. Like, so I suppose something that we're really experiencing at the moment is this issue of conspiracies that Owen is talking about there, or misinformation. And actually, like, in the 14th century, there's a couple of similar things where at the time, even in the context of the time, it's conspiracy theories. It's a bit before the Black Death, but in 1321 to about 1324, this took place in France. But there was a huge conspiracy theory that claimed that lepers, Jews, and Arabs, I think, had come together to poison the wells of France. There was, in the early 1320s, there was big outbreaks of various diseases, and this conspiracy theory did the rounds, particularly in France, a bit in Spain as well, but thousands of people were killed because of this, and it really shaped the narrative of that. And I just, when I was hearing some of the, you know, like the wackier conspiracy theories, I actually don't even want to go into them to give them any kind of light of day, because they're just really unhelpful. But they're not new, and I think some of it does reflect, like, what we're going through at the moment is not that different to what people in the 14th century went through when you face something that you can't understand. So, like, what we're going through now, you know, like, you guys have probably a better understanding, but say me, I don't, I'm not good at biology, I'm not good at science, and I struggle to understand the full thing, and it can be very disempowering. And then I guess when you hear a conspiracy theory that says, oh, it's this group, that group, or this is why it's happening, it can on some level be a comfort, you know? And I think that's a continuum throughout history, that you can find this blaming of one group or another. And I think part of it is, obviously, it's relying on older stereotypes, but it's a continuum through history, you know?
Yeah, but I think as well, it's a lot easier to retract those conspiracy theories and prove them wrong nowadays. Like, as Owen said, the appropriate health parties can just come out, do an online publication, and that's it. It's almost like the myth is busted. Whereas, like, in the 14th century, once a conspiracy theory is out there, how do you disprove it? You know, it's pretty much impossible. But I think when you look at, right, and we asked people for a question for tonight and stuff like that, and a few people asked questions along the line of, like, pandemics and previous pandemics bar COVID-19. But, like, I think what you have to take into account when you're talking about any pandemic is, like, what was society like at the time as well? Like, what means it have a COVID?
No, I think so, yeah.
That's the key parameter. Like, we're looking at something here that I think if a virus of this complexity and this transmissibility, if that's even a word, it probably isn't. I think if this was around in the 14th century, well, Black Death was about a huge mortality rate, wasn't it?
Yeah, Black Death, this is a big debate among historians. Don't worry, I'm not going to go into it. But you're talking somewhere between 30% in some areas, possibly up to 70% in some Italian cities, like the really densely populated cities. Weirdly, in northern Italy was one of the worst affected places. Part like the city, like Florence, brutally actually in the city of Milan was, they kept it down really low, and it was ruled by these guys called the Visconti brothers. And the Visconti brothers adopted this very brutal form of self isolation, where if the plague broke out in your house, they bricked up the house with the living and the dead in it, and just essentially killed. But it was really effective. And they were the only ones. It was, you know, it's horrific to say, but it was a way of containing the disease. I think what we're doing now is actually, because we understand how it works, we can actually implement social isolation without killing people. Whereas in the 14th century, they had absolutely no idea. Like, some people thought it passed on eyesight because it's just so contagious. Now, I think there's huge differences. Like, you'd obviously understand, like, I suppose the Black Death was a bacteria and COVID-19 is a virus. And it seems, it's very hard to know which spreads faster. Like, the Black Death took about 4 years to get from the Black Sea to Ireland. Well, no, 3 years, say. But obviously we've got these really, like, the rapid...
The one Yeah, sorry, Finn. The world is hyper-connected now, though. You know, like, you can get a flight to pretty much anywhere in the world within 24 hours now, whereas, like, back then, transport, travel, like, the people being the vectors of a lot of these things, or rodents or whatever it is, like, they didn't, unless they're birds, like avian creatures, the pathway for them to get from to an island like Ireland is completely different now than it was then. But I think as well, something that you said there with, I suppose, you were talking about, the point I was going to originally make was basically that if a virus of this complexity and this transmissibility was around in the 14th century, like, you were talking about somewhere between 30% and 70% mortality rate. We're talking about 0.7% in the countries that have gotten a real grip on this versus, you know, I haven't seen the figures from Italy today. I gather they're not great. North of 7.4% mortality rate, I believe, anyway. So while it is a comparatively low mortality rate relative to the Black Death, at the same time too, given the arsenal that we have at our disposal and the amount of information we have right now, like, this is a serious, serious virus. I suppose not to be all doom and gloom, you know, like, the blackout would have absolutely scarred society for, like, we were doing a sound check last night and I was saying decades, you were telling me it was centuries before society
recovered. I think, again, this is the doom and gloom thing, but no matter what happens, we were talking about this just, I don't know, maybe before you came on, DJ, but me and Owen, I think we're talking about this, just this idea that society won't go back, even what we're doing now, if no one died and we had to experience what we're going to experience, that is going to fundamentally change society. And just because it changes a couple of different things in terms of our outlook and perception of the world. And actually, I think there will be parallels with the Black Death. And I would...
Do you think people become germophobes or anything after this? Like
that, yeah, like...
Like, I think the, like, you know, the social distancing and you know, prevention of contacts and stuff, like, you know, obviously it is exactly what we need, but you'd wonder, like, afterwards, will people become, like, hyper aware of that and, like, you know, forms of greetings or whatever might change.
I was wondering, will people ever go back to it?
I know, because they were saying as well in Italy, now, this is a little anecdotal, but they were saying that the rate of transmission in Italy was quite high because of how they greet each other, where it's like two kisses on the cheek, you know, and they're much more close contact people. And that's why, you know, it would have spread a lot quicker as well. You know, so it's just interesting to see, you know, will that part of Italian society change hereafter, you know?
I think as well, when you talk about that, like, if this escalates, the worst case scenario here, does the Western society dispense of the handshake after this? Do you know what I mean? Like, it sounds ridiculous.
No, not the handshake. Anything but the handshake.
Imagine if you were in a pub at Christmas and you were told in 6 months' time people won't shake hands anymore. It just won't be an acceptable societal norm. But it is a reality. It is a possibility, you know.
I think I don't know if past, like, the only pandemic that really totally transformed society that I'm aware of is the Black Death. Obviously, there's others, there's the 1918 flu, but the one that we can really see this huge tale in terms of how it changes society. And one of the big things that people argue is actually the perception of death and how people relate to death and society becoming obsessed with death. Now, obviously, that takes a certain death toll for that to happen, and hopefully we're not going to experience anything like that, and I think it's probably unlikely. Or it also, people would argue that it heightens individualism or individuality, that, you know, this idea of the sense of self becomes even more important because you're talking about read a comment that needs to turn off the messenger there. It's but it can heighten, I think this could heighten individualism in society, particularly that people are starting to work at home, and, you know, the more time people spend on, like, it will heighten this sense of individuality that's already rampant in society. One thing that we talked about that I think is actually really interesting in this is if we're trying to compare how this may relate to past pandemics, I think something that we really have, and it's worth people bearing in mind, this issue of living standards that we talked about and in terms of healthcare today and a healthy population. Like, the last pandemic is obviously the 1918, then you have the 1830s pandemic of cholera or epidemic of cholera, and then you go back to the Black Death. But those populations were absolutely... like, in terms of healthcare, the majority of people had a really poor standard of living and weren't, like, the average life expectancy was quite low, and it was quite low for a good reason because healthcare was so appalling. And I think that would hopefully come to pass in this, that the general population are just much healthier.
Yeah, and I think as well, just like medications and treatment options, like, although at the moment, so I think as of speaking now, there are 39 clinical trials for COVID-19 in operation, whether being active or recruiting, or some are even completed at the moment. There are some treatment options out there, but it's just like trying to get that information around to everyone as well. There's like there was one study in France as well where they're using this drug, chloroquine or hydroxychloroquine, which kind of disrupts how the virus gets into your cells through like pH and stuff like that. But like all 20 participants, if there's any doctors listening, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think all participants were cleared of the virus, you know, after the 5-day course of it. So, you know, there is like kind of crazy stuff like already in operation for it. It's just, you know, like all these clinical trials have to be set up, which is a huge body of work in itself. But like it's crazy how everybody in the world is now focused on this one thing. Like same again with like, you know, as we were saying about like connectivity and stuff earlier on, like IBM Watson, which is one of the like one of these supercomputers in the world, has like focused all its strengths to try and figure targets for COVID-19, and like I think over a 24-hour period has, you know, found 72 targets or something like that.
What do you mean when you say targets? What do you mean?
Like, so potential drugs that they could target, so either like preventing it getting into the cell, preventing it replicating in the body, just, you know, killing it before it gets to the cell, all, you know, different types of targets for it. Like, but yeah, so, it's, I think it's like, so you know,
an example of a target film would be like if there's a specific protein on the surface of the virus that isn't on 50 cells, so all of a sudden you're saying, right, if we can develop an antibody to target this protein and we infuse this antibody into the body, then it'll identify this protein and kill those cells only. So it'll just target the viral cells rather than healthy cells. I suppose this is where we talked with doom and gloom earlier about COVID-19 and all that, but this is where it gets a bit positive, I suppose. And this is where modern society is in a much, much better place to adapt. I was going to say to cope, but I think when you look at what's happening in Italy and what has happened in China, cope would probably be the wrong word, but to adapt quite quickly. Like, we're 4 months into having this virus in the world, in humans. And like straight away, as Owen said, they've identified targets. Like hydroxychloroquine is one of them. Like that's a readily available drug that's used worldwide for treatment of arthritis and lupus. Hydroxychloroquine is probably in every community pharmacy in Europe, I'd say, you know, so that's real positive. But they've identified as well, like people who end up in respiratory failure. Part of there's two main things that drive the respiratory failure, as far as I'm aware, and it's the real intense inflammatory response that COVID-19 causes that isn't as intense in, like, say, standard influenza, which is why so many people are ending up in ICU and on ventilators compared to like the seasonal flu, and also this fever induced organ failure. So by giving people like simple drugs like paracetamol to keep their temperature regulated when they have symptoms, not to take it like if you're asymptomatic, but then they've found like drugs that are used to treat pro-inflammatory conditions like arthritis. So one is an antibody called tocilizumab, and that identifies a cytokine, so a pro-inflammatory agent. So when you get an influx of inflammatory chemicals into an area, for example, the lungs, you get a big mass accumulation of fluid, and it triggers, it upregulates a lot more of these inflammatory cells come in. So this tocilizumab basically just takes those inflammatory agents out, and it reduces the burden on the lungs, which means that there's less requirement for oxygen ventilation, which actually, while it won't actually cure the virus, it'll reduce the demand for ICU beds, ventilators, and that actually,
yeah, like even talking about that stuff, I find that fascinating, because you're talking about that kind of stuff there, and I think that is the real, like, just you've been talking about what is potentially going on in terms of how we're going to approach this. If you compare that to any previous pandemic of any kind, there's no comparison at all. Like in 1918, you've got a huge problem that you've got a population recovering after the First World War, so you've got demobilization going on, where these armies are being wound down, but these are all people who've been living in the trenches for years and years and years, so that their health is appalling. They went into that war, most of them working class people, having grown up in horrific slums in some of the biggest cities in Europe at the time. So these people aren't, now obviously they're not all, but like, you know, that is a huge problem. You have that underlying problem, and then just a general lack of understanding of medicine. Like, even, I know you guys have much better sense of this, but when did the miasmatic theory of medicine end? Like, that didn't that persist in some areas into the 20th century? Like, you know, this idea that of the humors and things like that, like essentially a medieval idea of medicine. Like the big breakthrough in many ways, I guess, is what I'm saying, has been in the 20th century. So that we have put this like huge gulf between us, and that I did mention this at the start, in that like I got a lot of emails from people going, oh, kind of do an episode on the 1918 pandemic or do an episode on comparing this in history. And I am a bit slow to do it, because I think one of the big problems that we face at the moment, and I think a big problem for our society, is an issue of misinformation and people panicking on the base of misinformation. And like someone going, oh, the Irish History Podcast said that this is going to be worse than the Black Death. You know, and like, but I think that's what people can take from these things, instead of going, I think some of the stuff that we're talking about here is, and for me, I think there's a really big question of how useful history is in this. I think there are, maybe what we were talking about 10, 20 minutes ago, like this idea of what does a human experience when they go through something like this? I'm not sure how much that ever changes. So we can look at the Black Death and go, afterwards, people were obsessed with death and it starts to show itself up in art and things like that. Fair enough. Afterwards, people have a rising, their sense of what they want in life is rising because their mortality has been made so present in their lives. What the threat that this pandemic poses to us compared to previous ones, I'm not sure that history has much to offer us there. It's just too different. It's like we're talking about a world where, like what we're talking about there, where living standards are appalling. These people are really ill, well, not ill is not the word, but malnourished. They're actually malnourished. And if you want to talk about, say, the Black Death, they're a generation that lived through, every generation of the later medieval period lived through a famine. That's part and parcel of life. So they've got these, like, inbuilt flaws, for want of a better term.
Do you think, throughout history, has there ever been a period of, like, say, a pandemic creating a period of creativity afterwards? Because I think this is what's going to happen here now with this. Like, you see a lot of, I think, like 2FM or have some sort of like creativity challenge out at the moment and things like that. And, you know, people are bored at home or wanting to put a positive light on things. You know, I'm just wondering, is there any point in history that, you know, came after like this, like a pandemic or a big world event like that, you know?
Yeah, I think the ones that people point to are just ones of like absolute, like what follows the Black Death is just total chaos. In the long term, yes, there is this change in society where you could start arguing there's some, someone is actually asking a really good question there. Do you imagine there'll be a baby boom in 9 months' time or so? I would imagine so. there is actually another aspect to that we might get onto.
That's creative, I suppose.
Creative, yeah. But I think if you look back at previous pandemics, what tends to follow them is chaos. If you get large numbers of the population. And I think, I kind of disagree with Joan. I think initially we're in week one of a lockdown.
Yeah.
3 weeks' time, if there's hundreds of people dying every day, I don't know where that's going to take us. I'm just not sure we'll be in. Like, I think I was talking to my sister today and she was asking me, going, oh, have there been an increase in listeners in the podcast? And I was saying, I haven't noticed a huge change. And I was kind of saying that I still think that at the moment people are going through the, what they would do on Christmas holidays kind of thing. You know, they're watching everything there is to watch on Netflix, and maybe in a couple of weeks' time you might then start to see different behaviours and maybe more people tune into podcasts who previously wouldn't have. But I think we're in that stage where people haven't really... I think behaviours will change, but I'm not sure creativity is going to be...
One of them.
Yeah, actually, just what that person has raised there. Sorry, DJ, just to do this. It was something I was thinking of. Very famously, one of the great books on the Black Death, or that deals with the Black Death, is Boccaccio's Decameron. And he wrote the first chapter of that is about, he witnessed, lived through, and experienced the Black Death. And, you know, he's got these four reactions to it. One is that you get really pious and you pray. One is that you go off to the countryside and basically do what we're doing, like hunker down. But then there was just other people who just partied it up and like had sex and ate all the food there was to have and just went, oh, I'm on the way out and I'm going to go out in style. And I have been wondering, will we get that reaction? I don't mean like people in the temple bar pissing it up. In that, like, will you get that? You know, like, there is a thing where human beings, and I think it's really deeply hard-coded into us, and you can see this in history, it happens loads of times, that if we sense an existential threat to our existence, that people tend to procreate or whatever. And I think it's probably some desperate attempt to pass on your genes that's happening in a deep part of your brain. And I would wonder, is that happening in Italy? Did it happen in China? Like, did people start coupling up together just because they felt this sense that, like, this is getting out of control and this could be my last chance?
I know, it is funny because there is such a level of selflessness and solidarity at the moment, you know, and everyone is feeding into that and everyone is, you know, doing so well and promoting it, and, you know, everyone's working extra hours or, you know, really kind of, well, how long can that last really, you know, before people just get fed up of it and selfishness comes in then?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, on a
cultural context, how is that going to work?
I was actually thinking, just on that issue, I was thinking of what would make an interesting podcast would be an emotional history of this. And I was kind of thinking of making this, of like all the emotions you go through during this, you know, like to start off with, like, and just because what you're touching on there, on where are we going to be in 5 weeks' time? And I think maybe history can maybe help us understand this. One of the problems with the 1918 pandemic is just the way it transpires. It's not the same. Like, we have this extraordinary level of knowledge. Like, we knew this was coming. We knew essentially the day it hit here, and now we can project, like, I don't know, I suppose we can, you can answer that better. Like, but the trajectory of the disease in terms of, like, flattening the curve and all that kind of stuff. Whereas I'm not so sure that in 1918, 1919, people were so aware. So I don't know, will that affect our reactions too, you know? And I think during the plague, it was, when I say the plague, I mean the Black Death. It was totally different, I think, because society was literally falling apart and the death rate was quite spectacular. And I think there is one other different thing, sorry, maybe this would be something you might be interested in talking about, is just, we also have sanitized death in a way that previous societies didn't. So when people, a lot of people who are going to die from this will die behind closed doors. Whereas in previous societies, it was your family member who was in the house where you were living and they died in front of you. And that was a very traumatizing thing.
Yeah, I suppose
that was like, God, he's full of shit.
I mean, not at that particular point. That ties back into one of the questions I was actually asked on YouTube earlier about life expectancy, and does a pandemic like this cause outliers and stats based on life expectancy throughout history? I think it's a really good question, because I think what we're seeing now in the Irish healthcare system today is a rapid adjustment to an anticipation of a wave of a need for everyone to move to critical emergency medicine. And I think people don't actually realize what that means for society that we knew it 6 weeks ago. Like, people are going to stop getting their cancer treatments. They're going to be on hold. People are going to not get surgeries that they've needed, and that's going to affect quality of life, and life expectancy is a knock-on effect. There are going to be hospitals around the country that, and again, this isn't to be alarmist, but this is just what will happen if we stay on a bad trajectory. When you say those curves, like, if we move towards the worst case scenario, like, people aren't going to get cardiac interventions if they have heart attacks. They will try their best, the healthcare system will try its best to cope, but if it goes beyond saturation, you're talking about certain hospitals in Italy being 700-800 bed hospitals where every single bed is treated like an intensive care bed now, and they are purely COVID-19 hospitals. So I don't think people realize that the mortality rate from COVID-19 worldwide is not just going to be who succumbed to infection with the virus. It's also going to be who didn't get this surgery, who didn't get this medical intervention because the healthcare system was saturated with this pandemic. So, like, we can see it coming down the line. We are better equipped to deal with it. But, like, as you were saying about 1918, but at the same time, too, like, make no mistake about it. Like, every spectre of society will feel a hit from this in some way. And I think it will change our relationship with debt. It might change our relationship with life and everything, but, like, society is going to change. Like, there'll be no bones about it. Like,
I think demand will increase. Like, what people expect. Like, we've spent so long over the last couple of years being told what isn't possible, what isn't possible, what isn't possible. And then literally in the space of 2 weeks, they've gone and done it all. Like, you know, well, you can't interfere in the rental market for tenancies. They've interfered, you know, land or mortgage moratoriums, all these things. Like, I was just amazed. I live very close to Nolan Park in Kilkenny, and that's going to be one of the test areas, you know, like the big massive testing where you can drive through testing. And they announced it last night. The army were there this morning doing it. And it's like, in normal way of doing things in this country, it'd be like, they'd announce it yesterday, and then, like, 2 years later, a lad would turn up with a shovel or a measuring tape and start, like, standing around. And I think, though, this is going to change our expectation. And that is actually, there's definitely historical examples of that, of where events like this speed up what we... our expectation, what we want, and our willingness to not accept no for an answer.
Yeah, but the willingness to not accept it is due to the fact that you can be affected by it. You know, not that, like, you know, say, like, people who are living in tenements or people who are living in direct provision, whatever. Like, there's no move to do this. Is probably a bit over politicized now, but like there's no move to intervene in those situations because it's not really going to affect you, like the government, but everybody can get this virus, like, you know. So I think that's one of the main reasons why everybody, there's just a worldwide focus on this, because it can just affect everyone. And if it's not going to, like, even if it doesn't affect you, like, there's someone in your family who is an elderly relative or whatever who it possibly could kill, you know. So
yeah,
I think that's a good point, though, because, like, to say something like, if you came across me in the street, you'd say, right, there's a young...
Homeless man.
Yeah, there's a scruffy bastard. But there's a young, healthy fella who you think is fine. But actually, I'm immunocompromised, so I would be compromised by this virus. But you wouldn't think it to look at me. And I think there's a great comment here on the YouTube. Do you reckon after
COVID-19... On the YouTube, DJ.
He's an old fella as well.
I keep saying on my own, but like, I think it really thanks for laughing. Do you reckon that after COVID-19 there'll be a re-examination of public health policy? To be 100% honest with you, I think after COVID-19 settles down, I don't think we're going to have to re-evaluate public health. I'm going to have to re-evaluate society. I think what the last few weeks has shown is society disproportionately puts value on certain sectors over others. And all of a sudden you realize how, like, fundamentally crucial the food supply sector is, food retail sector is, healthcare sector is. In the last 18 months in Ireland, you've had nurses go on strike. You've had doctors, like, crying out for GPs crying out for a new contract. You have these people who feel like society critically undervalues them. And you know what? The shit has hit the fan, and they're the ones keeping society going. So I think not just public health, I think we're going to have to seriously reevaluate where the priorities lie in every aspect of society. And if there's one thing I would hope to gain from COVID-19 happening, and it's a bit of a bittersweet way to look at it, and I don't really like framing things in this way, but I'd love to see a bit of a social revolution occur on the back of all this, where we can turn around and say, right, we need to value the fundamental citizens of the nation and of communities and an awful lot more than we have done over the last, I don't know, maybe 40 years in Ireland.
I think that's going to happen.
I hope it.
I just think that that there's a series of things being brought in. How do you turn around, for example, there, you know, the upped the dole by 50%, I think. So it's gone up from 200 to 300 quid, right? How would you turn around and say to people, or sorry, no, the disability benefit is now 300 and something. How would you turn around to people and go, oh yeah, now we say you can go back to surviving on 200. Or, like, you are able to solve this issue by all these drastic measures, but you won't solve homelessness. And I think, I guess what I'm saying is it could lead to rising demands. But that's actually a really good question that's just come in. On the YouTube DJ, there's a question.
On the YouTube?
Because I was wondering about this. I was actually chatting to my mom about this, actually. Do you really believe anything? Nope, sorry. The one on religion. Sorry, Ben Park, that was a good question too. But considering the impact on previous pandemics, how might this pandemic alter current Irish politics and religiosity? I think the issue of religion is interesting. I was just wondering, will people go back to the church? Like, where...
I thought it was funny as well. They were saying, there's no indoor gatherings more than 100 people. So you'd hardly get 100 people in a church nowadays, would you?
Well, some parts of the country you probably would, but
I probably would, yeah.
Majority of places you wouldn't. Look, I'm coming at it from an atheist who was brought up in a fairly religious house. Like, we went to mass every week and all that.
I'm getting a point there, one sec.
Do walk away.
Talk away, obviously.
I'm not sure. I think there's people who classify themselves as religious but not Protestant who might engage in it a bit more. I'm not too sure if it's going to be, for want of a better phrase, a resurrection of the church. I don't know, will Irish society move back to being I know in a census we're a predominantly Catholic country, but practically we're not. I don't know, will we move that way? I think people will look far more towards social democratic values rather than religious values. Personally, I think you see the Tories today, like, bringing in mad social democratic reforms, the likes of which Scandinavia would be proud of. Like, you know, I think to look at that question, how might it alter Irish politics and religiosity? I think there's going to be a mass. I would imagine we're going to migrate towards parties that are aligned, like the Social Democrats, and I think you could get a big influx towards that way of thinking societally. I don't necessarily think we're going to, and I use this word intentionally, regress back towards religiosity as the question was phrased.
I agree. I don't know. What do you think, Bob?
I don't know. I think it's a bit idealistic. I don't really see much changing, to be honest.
I think people could go back to religion.
I think people could go back to religion, yeah. And I think as well, even on the social front, like, I know there's a big upheaval now, but I actually think that people will see this as a wartime effort, and then what will replace afterwards, like, will just be back to normal. Like, once the economy starts going again, you know, there'll probably be recession, like, what was the word, austerity measures put in place post this, and people will, it'll just be the exact same all over again. Maybe that's me being pessimistic, but like, that's how I see it rolling along again.
That's a good point, Owen, but and the thing is, like, as Irish people, we tend to be quite passive, so Irish society tends to just regress back towards, like, what we've always been told. Like, we're a relatively young state. I mean, the Republic of Ireland wasn't a state the last time the pandemic hit, so when Spanish flu was out, there was no Republic of Ireland. So it is essentially the first pandemic that the Irish state has had to face. So in terms of what history can teach us, I think as a state, we don't have any historical evidence for what's going to occur next. But I just think though,
pandemic is, like, you know, like, that recession hit everyone very hard there in 2008, 2009. In terms of, yes, deaths this time, but, like, there's, you know, financial burden the last time. And I think the response to the state is just going to be the same, really, do you know?
Yeah, but then again, I think if you look at, say, the social democratic values that countries like Finland have at the moment, and you look at the way they value society more than an economy. So basically the way they look at it is the economy serves the society, whereas we have, for the last, for my lifespan, society has served the economy. It's been almost, you know, the inverse. And I just think if we don't have this short 5-minute memory, as some people are commenting here and saying, and we actually can come out the other side and decide we need to have a shift in society, then it will be that kind of viewpoint of, right, the economy has to serve society. I would hope that's the move that we'd make on at the end of this pandemic, personally. What do you reckon, Finn?
I think it is going to change. Actually, I think there's things in society definitely going to change on the back of this.
I just don't think the viewpoint towards like the government is going to change. I think maybe not, societally or culturally, but I honestly just don't think it's...
I don't think those things necessarily are mutually exclusive, because I think like people can have rising demands. Like, you can see that in the past. I mean, it's not just pandemics where you can look for analogies of this in the past. I've thought a lot about this, about like in terms of what, and like the analogy of a war. I don't know if that one is a really good one, or if you look, I don't know if looking back to previous conflicts is a good place. But you know, where society is tested under extreme circumstances.
I don't know. If you heard like Leo Varadkar's speech there the other night was Churchillian, like
what?
It was like Churchillian in its nature, like.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that I don't think we'll get the same outcomes as a war, but I do think it transforms society, because I think it transforms the way we look at the world, and we can still. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean that the political makeup would radically transform and you'll get a whole new political alignment. But what you may get is that people, just ordinary people all across the state, will have different expectations. So if someone says, like, it will be just unacceptable not to increase social welfare, or maybe unacceptable to drive social welfare back, because, a good example of this, it'll be really, really difficult to cut the wages of nurses and doctors after this, I think. I think there will be, and hopefully I'd really like this to come out of this, is that retail workers are viewed in a new light in this country as people who really went out there and took huge risks. Anyone who goes down to a supermarket sees this, of these people who are like, they didn't sign up for this. No one ever said that when you went to work in Aldi or Dunn's or Tesco's or wherever, that you would have to put, maybe not your life on the line, but the people you're living with, their lives on the line. And they're doing it. And I think hopefully that will come out of this, is that people will go, yeah, do you know what? If they go on strike for better pay, they probably deserve it. And like, because the other thing is like all those queues that we see outside supermarkets, that's a huge amount of money going into the people who own these supermarkets. So they should start coughing up. And I think, my point is, though, is the expectations. They're just two examples of how expectations will change. And I think on the back of this, and it's so hard to predict, because we have yet to go through, if all the predictions are right, we have yet to go through the really dark part of this. And I think that's the point where things are really, the experience and the memory is going to be fused in that experience of those, and it's what we take out of that. But if any previous pandemics, like say particularly the Black Death, or even if you look at the later waves of the plague that go on for 300 years, people emerge quite differently from these. Like it remains this thing they always remember, and people refer back to it. And I think that we probably are, our lives will be defined before and after COVID. I think that would probably be, it would become, unless, who knows what's coming down the line after this. But if there isn't something else huge, I think there will be, our lives are going to be defined by this event. And it'll be, I think it will be on that level in how we understand, if it is as bad as what's going on in Italy. I don't think people in Italy will ever forget what's happening there.
It'll be the new before Christ, was it? Before coronavirus.
New calendar.
New calendar.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Year zero.
I think you make a super point about the supermarket thing, because I think if you look at what was really growing in Ireland was the gig economy and zero contract hours and stuff like this. And we had a government who constantly put out a line that there was full employment in Ireland, full employment in Ireland, full employment in Ireland. What we've been shown is that that full employment was built on a foundation of sand, and that it took absolutely nothing to crash the employment figures. Like, what are we talking about? 350,000 people probably unemployed in the space of a week. And add to that the housing crisis, which, you know, was nothing but escalating. All of a sudden, when you put a lockdown on Airbnbs, etc., you get a massive, massive increase. I think there was a 64% increase in DAFT in the month of March in available properties in Dublin alone. Yeah. So I just
actually on that point, Finn, can we just ask you there, like how have you been affected? Because like you have obviously the podcast and stuff, but like you have tours and stuff like that as well. Like so,
yeah, you know, I was supposed to be doing a lot of tours over Paddy's weekend actually, and obviously all that was gone. And like my health does be up and down of Crohn's disease, so I was just like, even before it was cancelled, I was like, I'm just not going there because it just sounds like chaos. The podcast is growing as is, like, you know, because obviously I can do that from home. There is a problem in terms of research and getting to documents and things like that. Hopefully I'll be able to, I've got a good bit of content lined up, but yeah, if it goes on for a couple of months, it could be like the history of my house. how's it affecting me?
I suppose like, we're actually mad stress, quite in a fortunate position that we're both public healthcare workers working in a hospital, and so like for us, like whether we get COVID-19 or not, like we will be paid. So normally I suppose that this point we'd be promoting the Patreon and all this shit for us, but I suppose for the next foreseeable future, we'd actually just rather people support local businesses and stuff like that than throwing money at us. Like we're actually the fortunate ones now, and the ones that probably should be contributing to society. And then I suppose just on a day-to-day level as well, working in the hospital, it's kind of ramping up a bit in terms of just the, in fairness, the contingency measures that are being put in place by the hospital. And in fairness to the HSE, like a lot of people just not the HSE a lot of the time, but they're being very, very proactive with what they're doing in terms of like segregating beds, putting plans in place to have COVID-19 positive, COVID-19 negative hospitals. And yeah, like as DJ was saying earlier on there, that like, you know, to avoid the incidences of preventing like cancer treatments going ahead or preventing like cardiac interventions or anything like that, that, you know, you have these COVID-19 negative hospitals in place where the most vulnerable of our society can still be treated. But yeah, it's just so different. Like everything is just so focused on this now at the one time. But at the same time though, it's good kind of seeing all the evidence that's coming along, like that we were kind of speaking about earlier on in terms of treatments and things like that. So, and as well, like if you're kind of looking at China and things like that, and you know how they're coming out of it now. It's been their second or third day in a row now with no new local cases. So like a lot of their restrictions are being taken off. So, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel, not to be, I think a lot of this podcast has been doom and gloom. So it is good to see, you know, and again, I suppose that's another thing to talk about with like the communication channels, you know, the globalization of communication channels between us all, that like we are actually able to get evidence from them and see what China and Italy have done wrong and how to react on that, and you know, and put these processes in place. So hopefully that we're able to manage our healthcare system much better and, you know, achieve that kind of slower curve. You know, it like ultimately what that curve means is that like that peak curve was like basically China and Italy hit this huge peak curve where everybody's getting infected at the one time and they're ramping up, and they hit a level which is above the capacity of all the of all the hospitals in Italy or China to actually cope with it. And you know, you had China building, was it 14 hospitals over like several weekends?
Yeah,
in order to just cope with it. Like there's no way we're going to be, we'd be able to do that. So we have to kind of flatten that curve. They were basically building capacity in order to hit that higher curve. They were building and building and building and building to hit that curve. Whereas we don't have the capacity actually able to do that. So we have to flatten the curve and like hit, you know, make sure that the amount of cases that we're hitting is being spread out over a longer period of time. So it means that we might have a longer period than they have had to deal with this, but it means also that there will be a lower mortality rate, hopefully, with it.
I think that the key point here is that, in fairness, and I suppose myself and Owen work in University Hospital Waterford, for anyone who doesn't know, and I will knock the private hospital sector every chance I get, but I have to say, in fairness to Whitfield, the private hospital in Waterford, which is only up the road from the public hospital, like, they've stepped up to the plate massively, and like as Owen has said, have offered to use their facilities as basically a cocoon for the vulnerable people who need to ensure they're going to a COVID-free facility, which is in line with the national guidelines. But I think as well, what's important here is talk about I just seen the comment that you're laughing at, Finn.
It's for you, Owen.
The more points, the more chat. Trust me, Finn, that is true. I think what we're looking at here as well is, Owen has mentioned that we're both healthcare professionals, so we specialise in cancer care, so that's our background, and that's what we know. But what's brilliant with modern society is, like, as I've alluded to earlier, I'm immunocompromised, so if I get this infection and it hits me hard, I end up more than likely in ICU with a 50-50 chance of survival at 30 years of age. You know, that's not great, you know. So in fairness to the HSE, not only with that, but I'm in a position where I can continue my work, but work from home, and I can still provide a bit of value to Owen. We both work together. I can still provide a bit of value to Owen in the hospital from home, where I can go on my laptop and make sure that our documentation is up to date, and I can review and the updated guidelines and keep people informed, but from home, so that I'm not going to a hospital that is that has confirmed cases and potential cross contamination, to put me in great danger. Because like that's the balance. Like that's the key balance here. Like, ultimately, people are going to get infected. Like, we are going, because of Cheltenham, because of the Temple Bar fiasco, if we want to call it that, like, we are coming into the highest, hopefully, if people socially isolate appropriately and self-isolate when needed, we are hopefully coming into the 2 weeks where the country is most contagious. And if we can, like, pincer it here, then it's a downward trajectory after that, and we will be able to cope with that. But in fairness, the HSE and the private healthcare institutions have worked together on this, and they had to, because we have half the number of beds, ICU beds in the country per capita than the EU average. So we're at a serious disadvantage from the start. But in fairness, the HSE have got out ahead of it, to the most part. In terms of public health, we probably should be locked down already. But look, if people just cop on, like, we'll be fine. It's out there. It is out there. And we all just need to make sure that we absolutely minimize our own personal risk. And to the healthcare providers that are going into work every day, like Owen, like, fair play to them. Like, today was my last day in the hospital for the next couple of weeks. But there are people going in there every day, like, I think the original point was, how is it affecting us personally? I'm supposed to get married next week. My fiance lives in the house with me, naturally. And we had to suspend the wedding. But the thing is, like, she's a nurse. We talk about nurses in the country and how, like, every time one of our public representatives goes on telly and they're praising nurses and doctors, the nurses were previously on strike. Like, we're actually putting in contingency measures for life. If Niamh gets redeployed in a high risk area, we need to, like, divide our house then. So, like, that's how it's affecting people. That's the correct way that people should be looking at it, is, like, self-isolation, but, like, even self-isolation from your loved ones, if you're putting people at risk, So for a lot of people, it won't affect them too much personally. But if you don't take the appropriate measures, like, you could genuinely have serious consequences for other people. Sorry to take it on a bit of a downturn, but I suppose should we start to wrap up by asking some of the more lighthearted questions from earlier, or if you want to say
more. What I was going to say is we could wrap up by saying that we'd answer the first question that appears in the chat.
Oh, nice. Quick. Hold on. Fingers on the buzzers.
For the first question that appears in the chat, we all have to answer it.
Hey. The first question, I actually haven't seen loads of these questions. What? Tony Groves, who's he? He's a godsend.
No one's asking a question. I think it's time to, is it time to wrap up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Cool to boot up.
Thank you for tuning in.
So, thanks to everyone for tuning in. Yeah, for sure. Great chats. I'm sure hopefully we'll be doing it again soon.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Stay safe. Wash your hands.
Stay safe and wash your hands. I've actually only realised I've been touching my face for the whole thing.
I was following you through the whole thing. It's like, oh my god, this idiot.
I just want to say that, like, a common part in words that I use with people is stay away from yourself. But I am not saying that for the next few weeks. Like, do not stay away from yourself. You need it.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Shout out to finish room. On. Good luck.
Good night.
Shout out to their room for the
count.
Slánce.
Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.